It's Pledge Drive! This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO, Portland, Cascadia. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. In a moment, we'll be joined by Protop Chatterjee, author of a book about Halliburton, a very good read, and one that I very much recommend. This is, as I was saying, our membership drive, and I'm very excited about it. This is the time of year where we prove time and again and again and again that we don't need corporate or federal government funding. We just don't have it, don't need it, and we just keep on doing our thing, and I'm just so excited to be here. Before I get to Protop, I would like to discuss very briefly, sort of a storm warning, a little problem that seems to be appearing in the press just the last 48 hours seems to be worsening, and that would be possibility of war with Iran. And if you've been listening to this show, and if you've been paying attention to that situation, you know that proposed war has been simmering for so long that commentators such as Noam Chomsky have pointed out that it may well just be another pretext for a cold war. In other words, an opportunity to sell arms and to parade around in ships and planes and such and spend lots of taxpayer money. But things do appear to be getting hotter these days. There is an article in The Guardian, for example, which I've selected because it is one of the milder articles, talking about the fact that President Ahmadinejad of Iran went to Zimbabwe. And it's really hard to put your finger exactly on who said what when, but there is information in the press that there may have been some agreement to mine uranium in Zimbabwe for bombs for Iran. And the more you look at it, the fluffier, more nebulous, and more improbable the assertion gets. The Guardian, for example, says that the prospect that Iran had secured exclusive uranium rights in Zimbabwe for its nuclear program emerged following Mugabe's comments. George Charamba, Mugabe's spokesman, responded by saying that mining rights had not yet been finalized and that Iranians have a peaceful nuclear program. This cannot be said, he said, about the Americans who mined uranium in the Democratic Republic of Congo and went on to produce a nuclear bomb used in 1945 to attack Japan. We have our uranium and no one is mining it until we decide otherwise. Yesterday, contrary, this is still from The Guardian, to Charamba's assertion, Zimbabwe's industry and commerce minister Nikube said, there is no evidence that Zimbabwe has commercial deposits of uranium, so that question of the Iran uranium deal does not arise at all. And departing from that text, they don't have mines, so this is pretty much bogus information. And if it rings an alarm bell in your mind, it appears to be war propaganda finding its way into the press, I guess by way of various emails or phone calls from spook agencies who want to produce this sort of warmongering. I had thought perhaps it had come from the U.S., but now I'm starting to think maybe it came from Israel for the simple reason that if it had been U.S. propaganda, there would be much more of it in Fox News, for example. There is some of it in Fox News, and it's spreading through the blogosphere. If you pull up Examiner.com, you can find this sentence. Iran President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was in Zimbabwe celebrating a recent agreement trading Iran's oil for Zimbabwe's large amounts of uranium ore. As this ore might come in handy with the nuclear weapons Pyongyang has been selling to Iran, Zimbabwe Tourism Minister Walter Mazimbi invited North Korea as well as several other nations ahead of the World Cup. North Korea is the only nation to have agreed to come to the party thus far, yada yada. This sort of talk is entirely false, and it may bring to your mind Ambassador Wilson, who was sent to Niger, as you may recall, to determine whether a certain document claiming that uranium had been sent from there to Iraq prior to our invasion of that country was in fact a valid document. He found that it was a false document and that there was no uranium available. The uranium that had been mined there had been sent already, I believe, to France or Japan. I forget. It's been a few years, hasn't it? document was forged. There were no Iraq uranium bomb supplies. When Cheney discovered that this employee of the State Department, Ambassador Wilson, had done this, he demanded revenge, famously. He has not been indicted or jailed for this, I'm sorry to say. He arranged to out Valerie Plame, the undercover CIA, deep cover CIA agent who was doing probably one of the few things that the CIA has done that is a good thing, investigating and preventing proliferation of nuclear weapons. And Valerie Plame was, of course, Ambassador Wilson's wife. So it would appear that all that was old is new again. And we have, and the whole point of me bringing this up is that there is more war propaganda versus Iran, and it would appear, if you look at that and the war buildup in the Arabian Sea, Persian Gulf, there's a possibility of war with Iran, and it would happen quicker than most of us would be able to react to it, since where war planners are concerned, democracy is not allowed to interfere. And Protop Chatterjee is with us. We are talking about his book, Halliburton's Army, How a Well-Connected Texas Oil Company Revolutionized the Way America Makes War, now available in paperback. Where are you presently located, Mr. Chatterjee?
Actually, I'm in Washington, D.C. I travel a lot to the Middle East and Central Asia. And in fact, probably 8 months of the last year, I've been outside the country, largely in Jordan and Afghanistan and places like that.
I got that from reading the book. You do seem to get around. And much of your information comes from direct observation. For example, your story in the beginning of the book about Titoko Savawati, a Fijian who is working for Halliburton. I don't know if he's currently working for Halliburton. And is so low paid that he is without funds currently to get health care or even to get a ride back home. 50,000 personnel, you write, are in, I think you were saying, in Iraq for logistical support. Is that correct?
That's correct. So the term Halliburton's Army is partly about, you know, Halliburton has taken over the role of the army, but it's also an army of low-paid workers from Fiji, from India, from Pakistan, from the Philippines, from all over the world, primarily from third world countries. So one of the statistics that people throw out these days is that for every soldier, there is a contractor in Iraq. In fact, in Afghanistan, for every soldier, there are two contractors. And these are mostly not men with guns who work for Blackwater or DynCorp or you know, war profiteers like Dick Cheney or some such thing. But they are poor people paid anything from $100 a month to, you know, $300 and $1,000 a month. So Titoko actually worked for a different company. He worked for a company called Public Warehousing Corporation that got a subcontract from Halliburton / Brown & Root. There's quite an alphabet soup of these companies. You know, PwC was a subcontract of KBR, which is a subsidiary of Halliburton.
And it's directly
for Halliburton. Yeah.
I'm sorry. It's in subcontracting, you write, that some of the worst abuses occur. Could you expand on that?
Yeah. So let me explain that a little bit. When the U.S. government has a contract with a company like Halliburton or Blackwater, they are obliged in return for so much of our tax money to do certain services. And if they do the job on time and they do it well, they get a bonus. And typically, in fact, in a war zone, most of these are what are called cost-plus contracts. So for every dollar they spend, they get a guaranteed rate of profit. In the case of Halliburton, originally it was 2%. Since 2009, that's gone up to 10% for a company, one of the, particularly the private military companies that carry guns, that rate of return could be as high as, that guaranteed profit can be as high as 25%. Now, what those companies then do is they turn around. Typically, these are large sort of holding companies with management staff, but they then subcontract to other companies. And sadly, those subcontractors are simply subject to the contract rules between the main prime contractor and themselves. They are not necessarily, you know, subject to supervision by federal authorities or subject to the same laws. So Halliburton could get a job, could get a contract, and then they could subcontract to, let's say, Public Warehousing Corporation, get somebody like Titoko and pay him, you know, $1 an hour. And it wouldn't matter because, and no Social Security, no pension, and and that sort of thing, it wouldn't matter because the law doesn't apply to the subcontract, but simply to the contractor. So here's another aspect, and in fact perhaps it's reflected in the title, of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The United States used to have a draft army in Vietnam. Every man above the age of whatever it was, 18 or less, was not only eligible to go to war, was forced to sign up for the draft. Today there's no draft army. It's an all-volunteer army. And the size of the army has dramatically reduced. So they've made it up with these poor people. So in some ways the title, How a Well-Connected Texas Oil Company Revolutionized the Way America Went to War, Goes to War, is basically about how this draft army, where soldiers in the 60s in Vietnam had to go peel potatoes, clean toilets,
do all the logistics that had to be done.
And all the dirty, dull, and dangerous jobs are now done by low-wage workers from third-world countries, you know, who often don't get medical insurance and certainly don't get pensions and that sort of thing. Now, some of that actually, the medical insurance part is actually is quite interesting. Under the Defense Space Act of 1951, I think, anybody who works for the U.S. military, whether it's a contractor or a subcontractor or a subcontractor, has to get insurance. These companies often skip giving the insurance, so they don't tell them. Titoko, for example, I explain in the book, he was injured when his truck was attacked.
Mr. Savawati.
Iraq, Mr. Savawati. And he walks with this limp. And so at some point, we hung out a few times. I said, "So how do you get that limp?" And he said, "Oh, you know, we were attacked, and you know, I my truck rolled over and I broke my ankle or something." And so now he walks with a limp. I said, "Well, did you get any medical care?" He said, "Oh, they don't give us medical care." And I said, "Now that's illegal, and it is illegal. Every person who the wages are not guaranteed. The pensions are certainly not even required, but death and disability and health insurance is required. Of course, they've got to buy it from somebody like AIG. You know, it's not like the government provides it. But they weren't provided with that, even though it's required under the law, or they were not informed of their rights to get that insurance.
And so what does the law mean, absent any enforcement, I suppose?
Say that again.
What does the law mean, absent any enforcement?
Well, that's absolutely. I mean, I don't know if that was rhetorical or not, but you're absolutely right. Typically, the companies do offer the insurance, but for a lot of the third world workers, and since they make up about half of it, this insurance is either fake or not really provided. But one of the saddest things I've seen is that some of the American companies have not actually offered it to American workers and have refused to help their workers when they've come back injured. And that's, you know, this is something the Department of Labor can and should enforce. I believe that they should, if you have an Indian or Filipino or Fijian fighting, you know, someone else's war, the U.S.'s war, I think they owe a double duty of care to these people.
It's only fair. You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. This is Press Watch. And I'm speaking with Protop Chatterjee about Halliburton, and specifically the book Halliburton's Army, How a Well-Connected Texas Oil Company Revolutionized the Way America Makes War. So you've talked about, how little the subcontractors' employees, if they can be called that, how little they get and the conditions they work under. Let me look at the other side of the picture. How much is Halliburton setting aside in profit? Where do they put that profit? Do they send it to the Cayman Islands, or do they expend it in the United States? Also, what are the CEO salaries? What are the director's compensation fees for Halliburton?
Well, the company has quite a complex tax structure, and that's been simplified in the last couple of years. But one of the things that they did is the American workers actually were never employed directly by KBR, by Halliburton or KBR. But if you recall, I talked about the system of subcontractors.
Yes.
Well, they set up a company in the Cayman Islands called Service Employees International, not to be confused with the union, SEIU. This is simply Service Employees International. And anybody who applied for a job at KBR, they might have worn a KBR hat, they might have responded to a task order that was issued by the military to KBR or Halliburton, but in actual fact, their paycheck came from the Cayman Islands. So when those workers, truck drivers, cooks, supervisors, came back to the United States, they discovered that Social Security had not been paid. They had not. They thought they were, you know, they were getting more money than they were hoping for because they weren't paying taxes. So the employees.
So they come back owing taxes.
Well, they don't. But they also have no Social Security paid. So they go to Iraq to work, and when they're employed there, their check comes from the Cayman Islands. Therefore, they're not required to pay taxes. They also don't pay into Social Security, and therefore they lose out on benefits. And it also means, and remember this, because when you're employed by a company or any kind of business, you pay part of your taxes, and the company pays part of the taxes. So Halliburton got to reduce its tax payments to the federal government by subcontracting the companies out of the individuals out of the Cayman Islands. So they reduced their tax burden that way. Now, of course, the CEO, David Lassar, Dick Cheney, get very big salaries in the millions of dollars. So it's very different from what a truck driver gets, which is $80,000 a year if he's American. And if he's a subcontractor, sub-subcontractor, an Indian working for a Kuwaiti company, he might be making $1,200 a year. So there's a great discrepancy. And some of the big problems haven't been so much in direct fraud, because we talk about waste, fraud, and abuse in the world of contracting. There has been some fraud. There's certainly been individuals, and I described this case as a particular individual, Jeff Mazon from Georgia, who's accused of, you know, taking a $1 million check from a company subcontractor that he was giving work to. But really, most of the problem is in waste and abuse. So people have created elaborate tax structures, subcontracting systems, by which they can take money quite legally. You can prosecute them. But there's nothing illegal about what they do.
And it's legal, but it's very evasive, and that's the story you hear over and over about U.S. industry and U.S. finance, come to think of it, very much in the news. Sorry to interrupt you. And thank you for your patience, by the way, during our pledge drive. At this point, I've just been given some information. It turns out that we're not about to be joined by Membership Central at this time, so we'll be joined at 10 till instead. Well, great. That means that we can go on along this line of inquiry. And, I would like to know about the Bush boom, about the transformation, the increase in business that Halliburton got under the Bush administration. What changes have been made?
Well, you mean today, or what changes were made then?
I mean, what changes were made then? What transformation took place?
Okay, so... It's actually quite important to understand that procurement policy changes slowly over a period of time in over a course of many administrations, and rarely does one administration bear the entire responsibility for the transformation of, let's say, how business is done or how wars are conducted and that sort of thing.
Interesting, and yet the Iraq War was done very differently.
It was, but I'm talking about contracting here. So let's just step back for a second and see. If you look at Halliburton as a case study, they really came into their own under Lyndon B. Johnson, which is a Democratic president. Their first major $1 billion contract to go to build bases and cook food and that sort of thing was under Clinton in Bosnia and Kosovo. However, having said that, of course, their biggest boom has been under Bush-Cheney when they get contracts to go to Iraq and Afghanistan. That, however, has been sustained under an Obama administration. Halliburton is not getting any less work. They're getting more work, if any. And really, I would say that most of this is done, as I suggest in the title, is to change the way war is done so that there are less troops sent. They don't resort to draft. Because remember, this may seem unlikely to people in the left. But if you think about it, Bush and Cheney never served in the military. Rumsfeld, from the 60s onward, has always been opposed to a draft. So this way, by subcontracting to poor people from India, Pakistan, the Philippines, they're able to avoid sending people into a draft and not, I think coincidentally, also make a lot of money for themselves.
Well, of course, and one could also argue that by avoiding the draft, they also avoid the forced democratic participation of persons who might fear a draft and are therefore able to engage in more outrageous imperial activity.
You've hit the nail on the head. I mean, this is very important, that if you go back into some of the history of Vietnam, the anti-war movement, the draft dodgers, and indeed the soldiers who got to Vietnam. I mean, there was this incident, there was this phenomenon called fragging, where basically lower-ranking soldiers shot their commanding officers. Or in some way, you know, you have to understand that in Vietnam, according to histories I've read, something like a quarter of soldiers weren't actually performing. They hated their jobs. There they were, stuck in the jungle, you know, no showers, bad food, you know, falling ill all the time.
As the song goes, one, two, three, what are we fighting for?
Exactly. So today, what Rumsfeld and Cheney have done, and as I say, I think coincidentally and conveniently, at a great profit to themselves, they're hiring third world workers to come in and do this work for low pay. But interestingly, and again, if you read the book, you'll see I start out by explaining, you know, actually all the little luxuries that soldiers are offered in a war zone today. So today, where as opposed to, you know, the idea of a soldier going out there losing weight and, you know, dying of scurvy, the average soldier actually comes back weighing more than they did. And there's a PowerPoint example that I cite in the book from the military saying that the average soldier, instead of coming back 15 pounds lighter, is coming back 10 pounds heavier. If you go to there are people on the front line in the Korangal Valley in Afghanistan who live off hard rations and that sort of thing, but the majority of American soldiers live in relative comfort. They have hot showers. They have somebody who cleans their toilets. They have
Showers that may electrocute them.
They have hot showers that may electrocute them. That's true. This is kind of actually an interesting point, because you talked about the electrocution, and it has been a point of great contention where people have been upset that, you know, Halliburton has, you know, killed soldiers in the field and that sort of thing. What we do have is a system of outsourcing work to people from different backgrounds and technologies that are not necessarily compatible with the local electrical systems. And so you have people, you know, trying to build basically, jerry-rigged system, you know, in a war zone that they don't necessarily understand. So it's not that they're not capable of doing work themselves, but you have one of the biggest problems with outsourcing the war to private contractors, it makes the military think they can do anything. So the military says, we would like 5 bases built in the next 2 weeks, and then we would like to go to war in this particular part of Afghanistan or change something. Now, that doesn't mean that because they have commanded on high and they have used our tax dollars to pay for it, that it will happen. And one of the In writing this book, I've traveled to Iraq, to Afghanistan, several times to Kuwait, to Jordan, throughout the region, been on these bases, met with the people in charge. I know the CEO of Halliburton. I met him 4 times. I've talked to a lot of people there. And one of the complaints I get, which surprised me, was the engineers, the Halliburton people, saying, the military comes and tells us, do something by tomorrow, that is not even physically possible, but it's required under their contract, and they're paying good money for it.
So they do the best they can, is what you're saying.
They do the best they can, and they say, don't blame us. Now, you might decide otherwise, I might decide otherwise, but the reality is this transformation of the American military machine into a contractor-supported war has made the military do things that I think people would have thought was madness before.
Because, and I can think of an excellent way to cut down all those deaths and costs, and that would be just don't do imperialism. But I want to ask you about of course, that's not the situation we find ourselves in, is it? But I want to ask you about the resulting corporate culture, especially overseas. Quoting an article by Megan Carpenter in realitycheck.org, she writes, and you'll be very familiar with this story. In 2005, while working for KBR in Iraq, Jamie Lee Jones was drugged and brutally sexually assaulted by a coworker, Charles Bortz. After she reported the rape and underwent a forensic rape examination, she was escorted to a shipping container outfitted as a room where guards were posted outside her door, and she was prohibited from making phone calls. More than a day into her forced isolation, she convinced a guard to loan her a telephone to call her father in Texas. Her father called their congressman, Ted Poe, who called the State Department, who had to send embassy officials to her shipping container to procure her release. And, of course, there's much more to that article on realitycheck.org, and I'll have the URL up at kbo.fm, along with other URLs and information about the book that I'm talking about right now. But the story of Jamie Lee Jones' rape and her unlikely escape from the aftermath seems to point to a dangerous, hierarchical, I could say patriarchalist milieu for workers overseas for KBR, and I would presume also for Halliburton.
Well, I mean, this is actually true for the military, too. It's not just KBR and Halliburton that has these kinds of problems. You have to understand the military environment is mostly male. It is, in a war zone where the men cannot go out and do that, and in fact, unlike Vietnam, they're not allowed to drink, they're not allowed to consort with the enemy or travel outside their bases. So you end up having a very sort of introspective, closed environment where there are very few women working, and so they end up getting. And I want to point out that this sort of thing happened in Vietnam too. And I just met a woman in Washington, D.C., who worked for Continental Airlines alongside the Brown and Root workers in Vietnam in 67. And she reported exactly the same kind of sexual abuse. I think in those times, it was harder to come out. Jamie Lee Jones has been very courageous in standing up, putting up a website, testifying before Congress, bringing a lawsuit. But back in those days, you didn't say anything about it because you were worried that somebody might... you might get fired, and of course you might get into more trouble. Today, in fact, they're more this within the military. This happens. It happens among the contractors unfortunately, there's a reporter from Truthdig who I traveled with, or at least met in Iraq a couple of years ago, and she everywhere you go in the military, they assign things. Sexual assault, call this number. Now, that's for soldiers. And here's the interesting thing is a lot of some of the female workers there are not necessarily American. They don't necessarily read English. They're Filipino. They're Fijian.
So it's even more difficult for them.
Filmen.
I'm sorry to interrupt. We are running out of time. And this has been a fascinating interview. The book, Halliburton's Army, How a Well-Connected Texas Oil Company Revolutionized the Way America Makes War. The author, Protop Chatterjee, and I would like to give you just 15 seconds if you would like to make any concluding remarks about your book.
Sure, absolutely. People should subscribe to KBOO and get a copy of the book. So support listener-sponsored commercial-free radio. And if you want to learn more, you can also get articles that I've written on corpwatch.org, corpwatch.org, where we cover a lot of military and corporate malfeasance, whether it's fraud or human rights abuse or environmental abuse.
Protop Chatterjee, thank you so much for a very informative interview. And this is a very well-researched and a comprehensively considered book, and I consider it very important and useful. Thank you. Thanks once again.
Thanks so much.